Welcome to our paranormal afterlife. This is our paranormal afterlife, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. And if you want to hear the extended version of this episode, please join the Patreon campaign, where you can now sign up for a 7-day free trial. This week I'm talking to Dr. Robert Davis about his book, The Consciousness Connection: Extraordinary Human Experiences and the Nature of Reality. Robert Davis is an internationally recognized research scientist and author, and after receiving his doctorate degree in sensory neuroscience, he conducted research and was a professor at the State University of New York for over 30 years. His other three books are The UFO Phenomenon, Should I Believe?, Life After Death, An Analysis of the Evidence, and Unseen Forces, The Integration of Science, Reality, and You. Hi, Bob. Thanks for coming back to the podcast.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
So we're going to talk about your book. It's called The Consciousness Connection: Extraordinary Human Experiences and the Nature of Reality. And this is also linked to a documentary that's coming out soon, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Mid-March, Gaia International will be streaming it on their platform. And so Gaia International. And the name of the documentary is called The Consciousness Connection.
So I wanted to talk to you about the overview of the book. And you talk at the beginning about extraordinary human experiences. So how would you sum that up?
Well, it's a broad term. Indeed, but it sort of represents a pursuit of knowledge and the way people explore mystifying events that lead to transformative personal experiences. And over a third of the population has actually experienced an extraordinary human experience, which come in over 200 different types. But the main ones for our purposes that are largely researched and discussed in the media and internet platforms are the near-death and out-of-body experience and extrasensory perception kinds of experiences, synchronicities, past life recall, spiritual awakenings, including Kundalini awakenings, which I had back in 2018. Maybe we can talk about that. Interactions with unidentified aerial phenomena and non-human intelligences associated with or without the aerial phenomena, among many others, and they're accepted in most societies and in every historical epoch. So the question is, why is our mainstream science so regards this all as a pseudoscience and as paranormal? And that's what irks me, and that's what provoked me from writing my recent book, Extraordinary Human Experiences, entitled The Consciousness Connection, the same as the movie, Extraordinary Human Experiences and the Nature of Reality. Because while it's regarded as paranormal, it should be accepted by the scientific establishment, especially since belief in these human experiences that are considered extraordinary, exceptional, awe-inspiring is widespread globally. And it reflects this fascination that people have and the curiosity surrounding these many different types of unexplained events. Things that's our current laws of science within our materialistic paradigm can explain. So we're at the boundaries in terms of our understanding of what human consciousness is, a particular area of great curiosity for me. Which is why it's incorporated in the title, The Consciousness Connection, for the film and the book. It's an enigma in and of itself. So we're talking about consciousness as it is experienced by those who have extraordinary human experiences, and oftentimes a transformative aspect that an altered consciousness can bring about. After one of these experiences, a person does transform behaviorally, often quite dramatically, in many, many distinct ways, which we can also address. But the question is why? Why do they become less egoic, more globally minded, more ecologically friendly, less materialistic, less interest in organized religion, more interested in spiritual matters? They become much more humane in many respects, yet they always have that burning question deep within themselves. What happened to me? Why did I have a near-death experience or an out-of-body experience, a past life recall? These events occur much more frequently than we are well aware of. But survey studies, you have to get into the literature to realize the frequency and high incidence of these kinds of reports, and they probably underestimate the true incidence, because most people aren't going to admit that they've had some of these extraordinary experiences because of the stigma that is attached to it within our paradigm that we operate within. We forget what Einstein said. We all come from the same branch: arts, science, religion. They all coexist, and they inform one another. And yet we forget the subjective essence, that the science of the self, as I like to call the need for a new paradigm, call it the science of the self, trying to better understand the essence of human behavior. And especially with respect to these kinds of extraordinary experiences that defy logic, and they lead people to conduct research. They lead people to change their lives dramatically following one of these incidences. And that's what I find remarkable. In fact, when we interviewed for our film Dr. Bruce Grayson, one of the leading ND near-death experiencer researchers, he said there is nothing in medicine that can cause the dramatic shift in a person's behavior and physical being more so than a near-death experience. And it's true. People are changed dramatically overnight. The morning coffee tastes very different than before the experience. And it's very difficult for many people to integrate that experience into their daily lives. And it can be problematic, resulting in spiritual emergencies, with deep psychological problems that people can potentially incur. And this is something that has been reported in the psychological literature. People who have these kinds of emergencies, because these tremendously awe-inspiring events happen to them, and they can't explain why they had the near-death experience and why they experienced the deceased entities, past relatives who deceased, even recalling events that are considered accurate by a third party, known as you are well aware, vertical perceptions or verifiable perceptions, VPs, which to me represent the most convincing evidence of an afterlife, of the survival hypothesis, vertical perceptions.
Because with the vertical perceptions, they see things that could be a long way from their body. And there may be a materialist argument that they'd say, well, they saw something happening in the operating room where they are, so they must have had some consciousness.
Non-locality is a common characteristic, certainly, of near-death experiences, where space and time are not impeding aspects of the process. It defies laws of science, and it is inconsistent with people's experiences. But non-locality is the major underlying concept in quantum physics that applies to human behavior, where people who are in supposedly a comatose condition, where they are flatlining in the hospital, showing no signs of EEG or EKG, yet they're able to once they're revived, once they come out of the near-death experience, they're able to accurately recall events remote from their location that occurred during that same exact period of time, or that they are aware of people who died because they encountered them during their near-death experience, yet they didn't know that they had died, but they did. It, you know, having that be verified is often used as a good piece of evidence of a veridical perception. But there's one veridical perception that gets my attention was one that Dr. Bruce Grayson shared with me and my co-producer Dave Beatty. And it goes something like, there was a gentleman named Jack who had been admitted to the hospital for respiratory distress, and he had a near-death experience while he was in the hospital. He was having severe issues breathing, and his nurse named Anita said to Jack, "Listen, Jack, I'm going away for the weekend. There's going to be another nurse taking care of you, and I'll see you on Monday. Take care." And he wished Anita well. She took off. And while she was away over the weekend, Jack had another respiratory event and had a near-death experience. And during that experience, he encounters Anita. And Anita says to him, "Jack, I want you to go back and tell my parents that I love them very much and that I'm sorry that I wrecked their red MGB car." So he does. He eventually wakes up in the hospital, and the event was so moving to him that he told the first nurse that he about the experience, that he ran into Anita and that she had a terrible car accident, you know, thinking nothing of it. But suddenly when he said that to that nurse ran out of the room crying. He later found out that, in fact, Anita did go to her parents' house to celebrate her 21st birthday, and they did give her a car as a present, a red MGB, and she did take that car out for a spin, hit a telephone pole, and she was immediately pronounced dead at the scene. At the same time that he had that NDE is when she had that incident. So there's no way that he could have known how she died, when she died, but he knew through his experience that she did die. That experience to Bruce Grayson, that's the story Dr. Bruce Grayson told us, made him, and there's another incident too that he shared with us, a researcher of near-death experiences. It often takes certainly a kind of experience like that to change a life. It was just so, you know, it's just so, doesn't prove life after death. It doesn't prove anything. It proves that there is certainly something that exists in our reality that cannot be logically explained by science. And it has suggestions of the possibility of an alternative life. Yes, indeed. Doesn't prove it, but it's hard to explain otherwise. And curious minds, which I respect very much, especially look at that kind of evidence in the literature, the nuances, those rare glimpses of jewels of evidence. I like to call it as veridical perceptions. In my mind, are jewels of evidence. You need that third party correspondence and confirmation that makes it more valid, of course. Similar to shared death experiences that Raymond Moody coined back in, I think it was 1975, in his book Life After Life, which I recall when it first came out. And now, you know, he's a neighbor of mine now, so we were talking about. I got a real kick out of meeting him for the first time about a half year ago, a delightful personality. And he coined the term shared death experiences. Now, with shared death experiences, the person is almost experiencing like the near-death experience of another person. is aware that another person is dying remote. Again, getting back to non-locality, remote from where he or she is. And in other words, sharing the death of an NSDE. Now, this is even more convincing than near-death experiences because this event is happening to a person who is physiologically healthy and not near death with a flat EEG and EKG. So these kinds of experiences are impossible to explain, but they have that alterations of space and time, interactions with alternate entities, deceased relatives. Sometimes they're able to communicate telepathically with the people who they're experiencing. And sometimes the stories of a father speaking to their son, trying to rationalize what's happening to him, and the person's living in that the emotionally bonded other person, and often requires empathy to allow this to happen, apparently. So for those who are emotionally bonded or who have that interbrain synchronization, as some neuroscientists like to refer it as, will have these kinds of effects. When one is close to death, or like when the mother feels pain in the chest at the same time that the daughter has a car accident and slams into the steering wheel chest first, or the parent that feels a burning in the hand at the same time that their child burns themselves in school or something like that. These telesomatic events do occur, and they occur quite frequently. But you can call these extraordinary human experiences because when they do happen, it's remarkable to the people involved. You know, it may not sound as such, but when it is experienced again, it becomes a completely different. It's a completely different concept when you go through it. And that's why when it took me having my Kundalini experience to fully understand what a spiritual awakening is. I got a sense of it. I truly did. And I didn't ask for it. It just came my way. I had I gave a paper out in Australia, and I was invited to go to a party, and during that party, after the talk, there's a former doctor named Marie Batchelor. She just says, "Look, why don't everybody just sit around and we'll do some health, screening or testing?" And everybody just sits around, and she starts talking about cleaning engrams and developing healthy organs and removing timelines, removing engrams, negative entities, changing for the greater good. Things that, you know, you found a little unusual. But while she was doing that, I started coughing and couldn't stop. I never had such a feeling of coughing. I just literally couldn't stop. And it was something that felt so good about the experience that I can't explain, but enough to the point where I invited her to come to my hotel room the next day if she can and do the same thing as she did to try to evoke that same kind of response from me. Because I felt blissful from it, and it more than piqued my curiosity. So she was indeed very willing to do just that. And all I can say is that she started talking again about cleaning the engrams, timelines, the DNA, removing negative entities, et cetera, et cetera. And it wasn't necessarily the thing she was saying, what she was saying, but she must have somehow been channeling channeling some energy into me because I could not stop my autonomic nervous system going into overdrive and causing me to gyrate physically in tremendous ways that I could not control. And this is what's interesting. There was a true distinction between my mind and my body. My body was literally doing one thing, contorting, feeling tremendous energy, having to move. It was gyrating. My respiration was way off. I looked like Reagan in the movie The Exorcist, except for the vomiting. But I felt, while you, if you look at me, you'd think I was in terrible condition. I felt blissful. I felt purified. I felt I didn't want it to end. Yet we had a sense of duality. My mind and my body were distinctly in a different place. And it's that distinction that gives you a little bit more insight into what this consciousness connection is all about. But it does provide you with the realization that you're not your body. You know, you do come away with it with an important message. And that's what most people do when they have extraordinary human experiences of one or different types. Depending upon the severity level, and everyone is different, not just every personality is different. It is not unusual. It is quite common for them to take away that transformative aspect. You know, I'm not my body. That realization of something that's beyond the physical is a remarkable one. Something that everybody contemplates, especially as they advance in age. When death starts knocking on the door, we all wonder what lies beyond. In fact, I wrote a book, Life After Death, An Analysis of the Evidence, just because I had great curiosity in answering that question for me. So I said, well, if I want to answer that question, I might as well write something about it because I need to learn about it. And being in academia, in neuroscience my entire life, I've always collected data and written for journals and such. And so even in retirement now, I'm still doing the same exact thing. I just have shifted dramatically the genres. But I talk about, however, not entirely, I talk a great deal about consciousness and the enigmatic aspect of what it really means to us. And neuroscientists do look at the brain and aspects of consciousness, but will interpret it differently. Thousands of scholars, much more intelligent than I, have addressed the concept of what is consciousness. And to this day, it is debated feverishly. In fact, there has been a study on consciousness revealing that there are over 200 definitions currently of what consciousness means as it relates to how it is defined in various articles that were studied. You know, everybody's looking at consciousness, that concept, little differently. You know, there are certainly overlaps and such, but there are also distinctly different viewpoints. When you look at the monists versus the dualists versus the panpsychics versus the idealists. There's a wide spectrum of viewpoints that people can take on consciousness, and I've evolved over time. But the nature of consciousness varies considerably, and until we come together in an integrated fashion, all the physical and social sciences and the so-called scholars of the day come together and develop one consensus, one well-defined concept of what consciousness is. You know, we first have to do that before we can advance a paradigm shift that incorporates the subjective experience and consciousness into a new paradigm, not just the physical Einstein E=mc² Newtonian physics that we abide under, which we've done very well with, but it's not designed to address the qualitative, extraordinary human experiences that people have. It's not designed to measure it, but to even look at it. Don't you see? And yet it should be incorporated in a new paradigm. And there is progress that's being made as more academicians start to engage in more research and ESP, et cetera, but still far too few in number. And it's going to take, I forget what Max Planck said, the founder of quantum physicists, it's going to take one funeral at a time before we change a paradigm. Meaning, of course, it's a very slow process, indeed. And but with the, you know, you think with the internet and all, you could kind of speed it up. But people, you know, there are books on people who have Kundalini awakenings, for instance, which is what I was trying to describe just a second ago. You have this pronounced biologic effect on your body. You feel wonderful, but you come away realizing you're not your body. And that leaves you with a spiritual emergency, because becoming realistic about that is so contradictory of your prior experiences that it is conflicting within you. And people react to it negatively, emotionally, and can be depressed over it, not understanding what happened or why it happened. And for a good year, I was anxious. I'll be very honest with you. I was anxious because it was so remarkable an experience when you go through it. And anybody who does, well, can only come away with that realization. And I can't put it into words how remarkable it was. It means absolutely nothing to the person who has not had an experience like that. But your body's overtaken by an external force will get anybody's attention. And my body's behaving on its own will get anybody's attention. And I look at my body and I can't understand why it's doing what it is doing. Yet it feels so good and looks so strange and weird going through kriyas or yogic-like postures that many people do when they have these kind of Kundalini awakenings. It's a highly physical, energetic type of awakening process, causing them to go into pranic-like maneuvers. And I did, to some extent, and I didn't realize at the time that you're having a Kundalini awakening. This is something that people strive for having. They strive for this, and that's why they go into yoga or meditative practice, to achieve the Kundalini state, that advanced state of oneness or purification, however spiritual awareness is defined, and it can be defined in varying ways, through illumination and enlightenment, to purification and such. But these are objectives that people try to achieve and are motivating people to go into yoga, meditation, whatever spiritual minded practice one assumes. They all try to achieve this Kundalini like awareness, this state of being where they feel as one with their environment, so to speak. And you got to be into metaphysics to truly comprehend, you know. And I know a little bit about it, but I'm not a metaphysician, so to speak. But this you're at one with the universe. You come to the realization of what true reality is all about. And a lot of people who do have these experiences near death and otherwise come to that realization, and they believe it to be realer than real, unlike a trip on DMT, which is more of a lucid dream, more dreamlike than a true near-death experience, which is hyper-real to the person who has it. But they come to that realization, whether it's a near-death experience or something else that's extraordinary in the person's life, they come to the realization that reality is far more complex than they can ever imagine. And when they interact with other entities, they believe it. They come away with this belief, and that is real. You see, it becomes a philosophical discussion, I guess. They truly believe it to be real. And even though they're working on 59th Street with a suit and tie, you know, given their experience in the past from either a psychoactive drug or near-death or out-of-body experience, or sometimes spiritual awakening, or many other types of extraordinary experiences, they feel that they've interacted with alternate realms, other beings, deceased individuals, in a beautiful pastoral landscape, an alternate realm that was similar but yet so different than this one, sort of being at a different frequency or phase, as some physicists describe it as, which explains why we cannot perceive alternate realities. It exists at a different phase or frequency from the present time, but it does exist, but it's not penetrable or it's not observable given the physical dynamics of its existence. And we cannot get into that dimension. It's a different dimension, different time and place that you apparently supersede once you die, and thus no longer need this body. And then you become a pure spiritual entity. And I can't speak through experience, but this is apparently what people say. So you have to take that with a grain of salt, of course. And I, as a scientist, I try to be as careful as I can looking at the data. And it requires, however, looking at the data to fully understand the validity of ESP research in near-death and out-of-body experiences and all the kinds of extraordinary experiences I mentioned. People don't take the time or expend the energy getting into the research that does exist in these areas, and books, certainly, many decades worth of information that go unacknowledged. ESP, for instance, is real. Is valid, but people don't understand that. That doesn't mean I can walk up and read your mind because I have ESP. People have to understand what this means, and this is key. When you say I have ESP, it you have to be careful because it needs to be explained. What I mean is, people that do research in ESP analyze statistically the results, and the results could be significant at a particular level of confidence. So an outcome could be, say, 30% versus 25%, and that change of only 5% is significant. Thus, ESP is often said it is valid and significant, even though you see maybe a 5 or 10% change. Whereas the public would say it's so tiny. How can you say, you know, something is, you know, real on the basis of such change? Well, this is what I mean. It gets down to a debate, and it exists right now as a debate, the validity of extrasensory perception and these other types of experiences, because they're evaluated differently. And you have to incorporate that aspect of the phenomena, how it is evaluated and interpreted. So it becomes confusing for the individual who may be questioning it, as well as the person who's providing the defense about this. There's ample evidence in the literature of the reality of extraordinary experiences. It should not have to be explained in great detail. If people will take the time and energy to read it, they should come to, if they have eyes and ears, they should come to the realization that it is valid. I have no doubt. And what I find very annoying is that these experiences are valid, yet nothing is done. Don't you see? Nothing is done. And that's what gets me, because this type of information collectively, and I wrote a 500-page book, The Consciousness Connection, and just was released on Amazon, that addresses these kinds of human experiences, trying to make the case for why they should be part of a new paradigm that considers the paranormal normal, that wakes people up to the realization that we live in this paltry fiction of life that doesn't acknowledge the essence of the human condition and the extraordinary nature of events that can happen to people that can change their lives forever in a positive way, that are very dramatic and awe-inspiring.
Hello, Simon here. I conduct past life regression therapy sessions over Zoom, and these sessions can be very insightful and healing. If you go to my website, pastliveshypnosis.co.uk, you can book a free 20-minute consultation where we can discuss what it is you would like to achieve. You'll find the link to my website in the show notes. I wanted to ask you about the mediumship studies, because that's something that a lot of the public look down on, don't they? And they think it's just lies or people are fooling themselves. But there's been some great mediumship studies, hasn't there?
There certainly has been some great mediumship studies. And the what comes to mind is the work by Julie Bichelle at the Winbridge Association, where they have done very well-controlled studies of autonomic information reception, AIR, where they have trained sitters involved responding yes or no to questions from individuals about their deceased relatives. And in dramatic experiments that utilizes control group and trained mediums that they train at the Winbridge Institute, that they come out with a positive results of approximately 75% to 80%. They are accurate, in other words, to 75% to 80% of their recordings of individuals who are being addressed in terms of information about the deceased that they are familiar with. So, the fact that there is this positive outcome to the studies that they have generated at the Winbridge Institute, the evidence in near-death experience and out-of-body experiences has led Julie Bichelle, she's the director of the research, it led her to the belief that we are dealing with a form of communication, you know, with the living, even though they are dead. And, you know, she's highly convinced that that it is a valid procedure. And that's probably the best research that's going on in mediumship research worldwide right now.
What do you make of physical mediumship and the Skoll experiment?
The Skoll experiment was an extraordinary experiment in England, where people experienced the physical mediumship, the movement of hands and objects, lights, sounds, not mental mediumship, but physical. And you never know the cleverness of someone who can fool people with physical mediumship and using magic, so to speak, as a means to fool people. And this happens. Yet the people that participated in the skull came away so convinced that their experience, as they sat around tables and were touched by external events and people who weren't present, invisible connections, so to speak, things that could not simply be explained. And they came away with it highly convinced that they experienced something that was beyond life, let's put it that way. And the skull experiment has been analyzed and debated for a long, long time. And there are many who came away with it writing in support of it after a thorough analysis of the events. But this is the kind of research that you need more of. You know, why should there only be one skull research? You know, we need it to be verified, certainly, by a wide body of researchers from independent research groups. All of this research, is some of it is good research, much of it isn't. We have to look at what is good within the field and expand on that with researchers from other disciplines to better understand, you know, the where we're going with ESP and near-death research, to better understand what is the basis of this all. We don't have any answers to that. And that is what is most disturbing, yet it is most influential in the lives of people, one-third of whom have said to have had an extraordinary human experience of one form of, or another in their lifetime. So, you know, there's a lot of people that live with incidents of extreme emotion or a physical event that they consider extraordinary or incredible in some way that altered their life in some way. And for many people, it comes to near-death and out-of-body experiences. In fact, we went to Monroe Institute with Robert Monroe, the broadcaster and scientist who developed the hemisync technology to induce out-of-body experiences. He founded the Monroe Institute, named after him, of course, and I forget the year. I'm sorry. But I went out there to interview and film people for our documentary, The Consciousness Connection. That it was a wonderful place to be, and it's very well known as a place to go to learn about expanding consciousness and to have an out of body experience that Bob Monroe developed using his hemisync sound technology as a basis for people to listen to the hemisync sounds, the beating sounds of the music that he provided in the sounds that enabled people to achieve that state of mind. It's meditative music, and they could even use it today. They're using it today in at the Monroe Institute.
With the hemisync, what's happening there? Is it kind of synchronizing the two hemispheres of your brain in some way?
Well, you know, theoretically, I think there is a, one can theoretically consider that that's happening, that the two brain, two, the right and left hemisphere are working, in unison. And I'm not entirely clear that that is possible, or if music can induce that. But it's basically phase differences between two incoming stimuli to each ear independent of each other. You could put two pure tones into each ear, one being a slightly different frequency than the other. So you have 400 hertz going into one ear, 405 hertz going into the other ear. The brain will actually look at the difference in the frequency and generate a sound that represents that difference. So it will generate 5 hertz, a sound of 5 hertz. It's called a beat, and it will beat five times. It just does that. I can't be more simplistic than that. And it was the basis of hemisync technology, beating sounds. And he changed much of it. He played around with it in significantly to become much more sophisticated than just that. But initially, they realized the beat effect is a pronounced effect in terms of the effectiveness of the overall sound sensation on inducing out-of-body experiences, which Bob Monroe apparently had, and he explains them in great detail in the books that he writes about himself, how he come across areas of alternate realities. He came across a 2 foot long black hole in the wall, as he described it, during an out of body experience. Bob Monroe experienced. He started to have out of body experiences, and he cataloged them with fine detail in terms of identifying the places he would visit in the afterlife, the people he would meet, the events that took place. And he cataloged them with great precision. It's wild, because a lot of people who also claim to have come across another dimension explains it the same way. William Buhlman is one that comes to mind. He's a leading OBE, out-of-body experience researcher, and he too said during one of his out-of-body experiences, he comes across an area that represents another dimension, represented by a 2 foot wide clothed black area of space, something that appears that just doesn't seem it should belong. And it's a gateway to another dimension, another reality. This is the insight that apparently they come away with after having these experiences. Bob would talk about that. And he would experience these alternate dimensions. He rejoiced at it. And he wanted other people to experience the same. And he taught two scientists who worked with him in a laboratory in developing hemisync technology. Tom Campbell, who's in the documentary, a physicist, and Dennis Menerick, I can't recall his background. They worked with Bob in development of the hemisync technology that was patented in the mid-70s. And in fact, the out-of-body experience became so well known and so obvious to people who practice it that the CIA was required to send all their remote viewers, all the people who is involved with Stargate, Project Stargate, the secret U.S. Army Air Force Space program to spy on Russia called Stargate, to take that course at the Monroe Institute, where they would learn out-of-body experiences using Bob Monroe's method. They were required to do so. Isn't that interesting? They thought that that would help their out-of-body experience and their associated ability to remote view using clairvoyance, in other words, details of the submarines that were being built, that Joe McMonagle, who explained to me, he identified long before our Secretary of State did, using sophisticated tools of the trade. The Monroe Institute served many purposes.
Well, I wanted to ask you about the brain and it possibly being not the thing that generates consciousness, but something that perhaps filters it, and that consciousness is coming from somewhere else. And there's a couple of things there. One was the hydrocephalus, where it seemed that there were people who had virtually no brain tissue. But then there's also terminal lucidity, where it seems people with advanced Alzheimer's suddenly just return when their brain's not capable of consciousness?
It's terminal lucidity. And what else did you say?
Hydrocephalus.
Yeah. And, you know, Kim Peek, who the Rain Man was named after, he had hydrocephalus. He didn't even have a corpus callosum, an area in the middle of the brain that's supposed to connect each hemisphere. He didn't have it. He basically had a hole in the head. And yet he was able to read 12,000 pages of a book. One eye would read one page, the other eye would read the other page, and he was able to recite it backwards and forwards. These are some autistic savants have this kind of ability. Even with the brain, with hydrocephalus or with malformations, can do things that we can never understand, can't figure out. That's why there's some people that study the behavior of autistic savants and believe that they're tapping into the Akashic records, trying to figure out how they can speak many different languages at age 3. I know a neuropsychiatrist, Diane Powell, who's done research with autistic savants. She wrote the book, The ESP Enigma, proving that there are autistic savants that have ESP. She also identified someone who is 4 or 5 years old who could speak 6, 7 different languages without ever prior exposure to them, or figure out the answer to a cube root number without ever having mathematical exposure. And I'll be talking about someone who's under 5. And what tipped her off was that they often say the answers just come to my head. I don't think of it. See, that's what got her. I don't think of it. They just come into my head. And the only explanation some people come up with is that there must be an information field that where all answers exist that may or may not be accessible to people. It may be accessible to autistic savants for some reason. For some reason they can't tolerate this time and space. Maybe that's why they act the way they do. But when it comes to accessing information from beyond, maybe they are doing it. These answers just come to them. It's like when the marbles fall on the floor and the Rain Man, will count each one. Yeah, he doesn't count each one. The answer just comes to him. The number's already figured out, and he's able to find that number. Just comes to him. It's just weird, isn't it? That something can pop into your head like that. But that's what people claim. And there are many, many instances in history where leading scientists have said the same. General relativity just popped into Albert Einstein's head during the dream. It wasn't me. It was a dream, he said. Same was true with the discovery of electricity. It wasn't my idea. Some will admit that. Some egoless scientists will admit that. It wasn't my idea. Steven Jobs said something of the same thing regarding the phone. It wasn't my idea. It wasn't my idea. They do believe that it's something else was involved for the great discoveries, the tremendous discoveries. I think we have tremendous discoveries here with the EHEs, the extraordinary human experiences. They are just great discoveries that people should eventually be making. And they're trying to figure out why so many millions of individuals are having these kinds of experiences. 200,000 people alone in the United States have a near-death experience each year. That's a lot. 200,000. Especially with the advent of life-sustaining technologies. But if you start adding that up every year across countries, millions of people a year are having these kinds of experiences. And having a near-death experience is not a simple procedure. It is a dramatic, life-altering event in many cases. Maybe not all, but in many cases it is. lives are changed dramatically from that moment forward. And people don't understand that. It's not written down in any obvious location. Why would people read such information? You know, where are you going to go to hear such information, right? It's not customary language that's used on an everyday basis, we see on TV or otherwise. But we are seeing this metamorphosis, in a sense, of people having these experiences with no answers. And I do believe it requires a greater attention on the part of science to try to help us figure out what is going on, and to come to the realization that we must incorporate the science of the subjective in a new analysis of what is going on, because that's one way in which it can be analyzed. There are physiologic ways as well, but it requires a combined approach. It certainly does.
Well, it's been great having you back on the podcast, and the book's called The Consciousness Connection, Extraordinary Human Experiences and the Nature of Reality. And people can get that on Amazon and other places, can't they?
Yes, you can get that on Amazon, ebook or regular book. It's 500 pages, written fairly friendly. And I certainly hope you enjoy it.
Well, thanks again for coming on the podcast.
Well, it's an absolute pleasure. And look for the documentary in mid-March. That's based on the book. Name is The Consciousness Connection, and that's streamed by Gaia. And my co-producers, Dave Beatty and Wilson Hawthorne, they made the film possible. And this book serves as the inspiration for that film. So thank you again for inviting me on. I appreciate it very much, Simon. Very kind of you.
So this week I was talking to Dr. Robert Davis about his book, The Consciousness Connection, Extraordinary Human Experiences and the Nature of Reality. And a great way to support the podcast is to join Patreon. The Patreon episodes are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. You can become a patron by going to patreon.com/ourparanormalafterlife or click on the Patreon button on my homepage at pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. The links are in the show notes. And look out for our Paranormal Afterlife episodes called Paranormal Stories that are released every Thursday. And if you enjoy the podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.